The click of the boss's claws against the rock floor stops, and I hear the smallest sigh. I hear the hunger in it. There is a creature hidden in the caves of Whistler Beach, held to the salt and sand by a spell and a deal struck on a stormy sea over 200 years ago. She has no name that she's given us. My great-grandfather called her the boss. Grandma always called her our co-worker. But the people of Whistler Beach and the clients who seek out our services, they have a different name for her. The little lantern flickers out, and just as I have for more than half my life, I listen to the memory eater take her first meal of the day. That's a quote from The Memory Eater by Rebecca Mahoney. This is YA Book Chat, and I'm your host, Leah Stuhler. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of YA Book Chat. Thank you so much for being here and for listening. I appreciate your continued support. Today, I have another fantastic author interview for you guys. I'm really excited to be interviewing Rebecca Mahoney today about her newest book called The Memory Eater. Rebecca is also the author of The Valley and the Flood, and The Memory Eater actually just came out in March, so it hasn't been out very long, but it is a fantastic book, and I'm really excited for all of you to hear about it today and to be able to hear Rebecca. Welcome to the podcast, Rebecca. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Well, why don't you tell everyone a little bit about yourself to get us started?
All right. Well, I'm Rebecca Mahoney. As you said, I am the author of both The Valley and the Flood and The Memory Eater, both of which are YA. I am a lover of horror, a lifetime New Englander, and I live with two fabulous roommates and a cat named Mouse.
I love that your cat's name is Mouse. That is fantastic.
It's the perfect name for her. She's so little.
Oh, and there's a lot of irony mixed into that with, you know, mice and cats. So very fun. We are on the verge of getting two little kittens ourselves. We have gone to the animal shelter. We have put our name down and have claimed them. We are just waiting until they are big enough so that we can bring them home. So,
oh my gosh, I'm so excited for you. I love kittens.
Ours are going to have very different names though than Mouse. One is going to be named We have a brown tabby who's going to be named Mando after the Mandalorian.
Oh, yeah.
And then the other one is an orange tabby who I was hoping was a girl so that I could name her Buttercup, but it's a boy. Okay. So that's fine. He's still getting a Princess Bride name, so he's going to be called Wesley.
Oh, Wesley is very good. Mm-hmm. I found out recently most orange cats are boys.
Huh. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was new information to me too.
Very interesting. Well, hey, you learn something new every day. So you said that you like horror, which I think is really fun. And I did read in your bio on your website that you have been inspired by classical Japanese ghost stories and their influence on modern horror genre. I have read a few Japanese ghost stories myself. My favorite one is called The Love Test, and it's fantastic. But tell me a little about this. Like, what is it about Japanese ghost stories that you love so much and you love to like study and see how they've influenced horror?
Well, first of all, I hadn't heard of The Love Test, so I'm really excited to look into that. Second of all, I'm so glad you asked this question, because this definitely opens up quite a can of worms for me. So I'm going to try not to go off in too many different directions here. But I have always been a horror fan. And I sort of, I came of age, I was a teenager. At the time, there was a big Japanese horror boom in Hollywood. So when I was in high school, both the American remakes of The Ring and The Grudge came out. Mm-hmm. And I, of course, quickly tracked down the originals of both. And that really got me into horror in a deeper way. I got to do some deep dives in college that really sort of drew me into the mechanics of horror. My Japanese teacher found out that I was really into it, and she assigned a translation of a Japanese ghost story. So I got to play around a lot with how to translate the use of, like, there's a lot of repetition and onomatopoeia in the classic ghost stories. So it was cool to find sort of the English equivalent for that. And I also really loved reading about the classical roots of a lot of the tropes and visual shorthand in modern Japanese horror. One of the older and more popular and frequently sort of adapted Japanese ghost stories is Yotsuya Kaidan, where the Onryo, which is a vengeful ghost, was sort of, I don't know that it was the first depiction of a vengeful ghost, but it sort of popularized it.
Okay.
And in adaptations, in like Kabuki for Yotsuya Kaidan, there was this visual shorthand for the vengeful ghost, which was the white burial kimono, the long stringy hair, and white face paint with sort of a blue cast to it. Mm-hmm. And you still see that crop up in modern Japanese horror movies. So it was really cool to see how those tropes sort of renew themselves and persist like year after year. But what really sort of drew me in on a deeper level was when I watched these movies and got terrified like everyone else. I was like, why is this so scary? Like, why does this feel scarier than other horror I've watched when I've been watching all my life? So it was really interesting to look at sort of, you know, the Western set of tropes, which our ghost stories are more settling unfinished business and finding catharsis. Mm-hmm. And like The Ring and The Grudge play with that a little bit. Like they set up the expectation that you might be resolving unfinished business, and then they explicitly reject that. Those ghosts are sort of an unstoppable, inevitable force. So I ended up watching those movies a lot and sort of taking apart why they were so scary and why those tropes were different than the tropes I was used to. And all that said, my own horror tends to be closer to those Western tropes of like catharsis and solving the unfinished business. But it really sort of helped me solidify my own understanding of tone and like modulating the emotion of horror to figure out what emotion I want to leave the audience with. And it definitely taught me the mechanics of a good scare.
Yeah. And you mentioned The Ring, which automatically made me shiver because that movie. And let me tell you, I did the thing that you're not supposed to do when I watched that movie. I didn't go see it in the theater. Okay. The first time I ever watched it, I was at home by myself because I was living by myself at the time. I was engaged, but not married. And we lived like hundreds of miles away from each other. So, but I had a first floor apartment and with a like a common area in the back that had a lot of like trees. And I mean, it's beautiful, but it also sets up, you know, a certain creepy feel if you watch horror movies late at night. So I made the mistake of getting The Ring and watching it late at night when it's like pitch black outside. And I was like, I'm going to give myself a good scare. And I had like all the lights off, scared the pants off of myself. I like could not sleep that night because like I loved the movie, but I also just scared the crap out of myself. And I'm in my bedroom and there was a tree that's like right outside of my bedroom window.
Oh no.
And I was trying to go to sleep and I couldn't sleep because all I'm seeing in my head are all these visuals from that movie. And then I'm looking out my window and I just see the shadow of the tree. But of course, in this state, I'm like, my head is playing tricks on me. And I'm like, oh my God, there's somebody outside of my window, you know? And I had to like keep telling myself, it's just your imagination. It's just your imagination. And then I vowed to never watch horror movies like that before I went to bed again. So, you know, but it is fantastic.
Oh, I think the only thing that saved us from a nationwide panic was the fact that VHS tapes had mostly been phased out by that point. Mm-hmm. Because watching The Ring on VHS, I think, would have been too much.
I agree. <It's> just, and if you're listening to this and you don't know what a VHS tape is, okay, that means A, you're super young, which is fine. But B, go Google it, okay? And then you'll understand. So, but yeah, and I love that you brought up Kabuki also, because I'm actually a theater teacher. And so I do a unit for my eighth grade where we study theater from other countries, Eastern theater especially. And we learn that all about Kabuki theater. And I knew when you were describing like the white face with the bluish hint and this like stringy black hair, I knew exactly what you're talking about. And I could like completely envision that in my head. And yeah, like, because their characters aren't like real people. They're all spirits. So I love that you were able to relate it to that too. It's great.
It's one of my favorite little like nuggets of information. I love that sort of like theatrical, almost dance aspect it adds to those movies.
Yeah, definitely. It's really great. And you should definitely look up The Love Test and read it. I discovered it when looking up ghost stories for my eighth graders as well for a storytelling unit that we do. And it's like become my favorite ghost story. I love it. It's super creepy and dark and fun.
Ooh, I am making this a priority.
Yes. I always leave that story for me to tell my students. And they're always like so creeped out by it. It's hilarious. It just makes me happy.
I love that.
But I am curious because The Memory Eater is like, it's a really cool and unique story. And so I was kind of wondering, well, first, I would love for you to tell everybody what the story is about. And then after we can talk about, you know, how the idea for it came about and if any Japanese ghost stories or, you know, what horror may have inspired it.
Well, so my sort of elevator pitch for The Memory Eater is so Memory Eater follows Alana, a 17-year-old girl in a little beach town in Maine who's just inherited a very different kind of family business. So she's been charged with working with this memory eating monster to purge the unwanted memories of the people around her who are willing customers. So when Alana's own missing memories lead to the monster's escape, Alana learns that forgetting always comes at a price. So how this story came about was I started quite a long time ago, actually. This started as my NaNoWriMo project in 2014, and it has gone quite a few iterations since then. But I started with sort of the idea of this girl who is quite literally responsible for the emotional labor of her entire town. And actually, I sort of started with Alana being the one who takes on the memories herself. But I really enjoyed sort of the eventual shift into a monster story and the back and forth of Alana and the Memory Eater. So while this wasn't inspired by a Japanese ghost story, this is in part inspired by a piece of Japanese media, which really informed the way I approach monster stories. So this is an anime and manga called Mushishi, and it's sort of set in this nebulous ancient Japan. And so these creatures called Mushi are sort of megafauna, sort of. They're these ephemeral beings who aren't even visible to humanity for the most part. They just sort of go around affecting people's lives in these different ways. And most of them are in negative, sort of scary ways, but occasionally they can bring good luck. So this character goes around sort of solving all these problems. It's an anthology setup, mostly focused on these one-off characters and their emotional arcs and how these are resolved sort of in combination with dealing with the Mushi. But the quote, I believe I watched this when I was in college and it just blew my mind wide open, was the main character's sort of approach to the Mushi is like, everything is as it is and everything acts in according to its nature. And that is sort of what I bring to monster stories. Like I enjoy when they're terrifying. I love when they're terrifying, but I do like to approach them as this thing that's completely separate from humanity and has its own sort of view of the world and its own ways of communication and how to bridge that sort of gap between the human and the monster and what those two parties figure out about themselves along the way. And certainly that was a bit more direct in the valley and the flood where my main character Rose literally couldn't communicate with this monster. The Memory Eater has a few more human qualities for reasons you figure out. But that aspect of like trial and error communication and all of the chaos along the way still is true across my monster stories.
I love a good monster story. Got to have good, strong monsters in there. And
I love a monster.
Yeah. And this was like a very unique monster. I've never read a story like this before with, you know, a monster who's like eating people's memories. So when I first read the premise for it, I was very, very intrigued by it because I thought like, what would that be like? What would that be like if there was this like monster who ate memories? What if I had memories that I wanted to get rid of? Would I really be able to do that? Mm-hmm. Like willingly go to this monster and get rid of them? Or would I end up regretting it later? You know, like, is it a thing where I would be like, okay, I would rather forget that guy that I dated in college. Let's get rid of those memories. You right. know, or was it like, this really traumatic thing happened and I want to forget about that. You know, like it's probably, right. I mean, and it's a mixture, I think, for the characters in the book who get their memories taken away. Yeah. And then, you know, there is that thought like Alana, you know, do I want those back? Do I regret getting rid of those memories? So.
Right. Yeah. And I think the question that Alana sort of uncovers throughout the book and encounters in different ways through a lot of these characters who've given up their memories is this question, like, one, am I the same person for better or worse if I haven't had those experiences? And especially for in Alana's case, if you forget the worst mistake you've ever made, do you just make it again?
Oh, yeah, that's true. I mean, we're, you know, like, are we fated to do that kind of thing? You know, or that yeah. is it just going to happen again, even if we forget about it? Like,
exactly.
I mean, it's, you know, it's our human nature, just because we forget about, I forget things all the time, but
me too.
I mean, I'm not going to do things again. So, you know, I want to ask you before we dive more into the story in thinking about this, the cover for this book is so fantastic. Like I loved
Isn't it.
The when Lane Mandros at Books Forward sent me this book and I was looking at it, I was like, oh my gosh, that is amazing. Like, and I remember posting it on Instagram being like, look at this. Like, it's so fantastic. And it's just so fun. Why don't you tell everybody kind of a little about the cover and like, were you involved in the development of that at all?
Oh my gosh. So my cover is amazing. My cover artist, Justina, is a genius. So I, Razorbill for my imprint is very sort of, they like to encourage you to really get involved in giving feedback on the cover design. They're very open to critique. But of course, the only critique I really had was, oh, Alana's hair is a bit curlier than that. Like the cover comps were just amazing from the beginning. There were little things that were tweaked along the way. I think the biggest sticking point was what the text color was going to be. And of course, we went with that incredible red orange. But it was the sketches were just incredible from the beginning. I look at it all the time. I feel so fortunate.
And if you guys, for those of you who maybe are like, what are you talking about? The cover of this book is so fantastic because you've got the memory eater on it. And it's like, she's got like all these like multiple like arms kind of from all these memories reaching out and Alana is in the middle and yeah, the colors are just amazing. And I do love her curly hair in that picture. It's fantastic.
Right. Yeah. The design for Alana is beautiful. And the way that the hands just kind of encroach on her space. Mm-hmm. It's genius.
It is. It's so fantastic. So y'all listening should go Google this right now if you haven't seen
yes,
it, because it's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. So, well, I want to talk a little bit more about the story of the book without giving away any spoilers, of course. I really loved the magic system that's in the book because the magic kind of operates a little bit differently for each member of the Harlow family, Alana's family, and they each kind of have their own way that they use the magic, but then they all have to use one aspect of the magic in the same way in order to keep the memory eater where she is. So talk to me about developing the magic system for this story.
Absolutely. So my like genre fiction, my horror especially, does usually come from a place of heavy emotion. Like I think that I tend to write to explain at length like emotions that are hard to understand. So, and especially where Alana is, again, literally doing the emotional labor of this entire town, I wanted the magic system to be very emotion-based. And especially because Alana's been put in this position from a very young age where she has to sort of constantly use and even monetize her empathy for these people who are coming to her. And she does genuinely feel that empathy, but she also has to feel it. And that's like really exhausting. Mm-hmm. So it, like when I was thinking about this story and sort of the ways she was going to renegotiate her relationship with like that emotional energy for herself, for her community, for the people who love her, I wanted all of the magic to be empathy based. So without giving away too many spoilers, since I know a few of those are revealed through the book, all of the Harlow magic has a give, a take, and a way that if your emotions are unstable, it can sort of rebound back onto you, the way emotions tend to do sometimes.
I did love the emotion aspect of it too, because, you know, you think about it, like our emotions affect so many things that we do. And when I intensify, it changes who we are and what we do and how we do things, you know, like you're mad about something, you're going to like hold that orange in your hand like a little tighter and squeeze it. You know what I mean?
Whereas exactly. If you're happy,
you know, so, and magic always has to have some kind of price to it, of course.
Exactly.
So I think the emotions going along with this magic system worked so well. It was just a great pairing for the way that it all works out.
I'm so glad. And it made it really fun to sort of have Alana grow throughout the story, because she had been trained so early in her life to keep her emotions so strictly in check. And I always love a story arc where a character has to learn to respect their own emotions. But for Alana, it was a little bit harder than most characters.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in talking about Alana, she goes through so much in this book, you know, and she has a lot of pressure on her also, because she's the last Harlow standing. You know, she's only 17, but she's in charge of keeping the memory eater in the cave and fed. You know, and like you said, she, in doing that, she's dealing with not just her emotions, but the emotions of other people as well. Like all of her customers, we'll say, you know, who come to have their memories taken away, a lot of them are dealing with different things and want these memories taken away for very emotional reasons. And she kind of like, you know, feeds off of that. And then she's realizing, you know, she's missing some of her memories, and that's important because she may need some of those memories back with things that happen as they occur in the story. She's dealing with a mother who walked out on her after her grandmother died, her mom's mom, you know, because her mom didn't want to be the Harlow in charge and didn't want to run the business. So there's a lot, you know, she's struggling. She's got some relationship things that are going on. So she's a very complicated character with a lot happening. And she does grow a lot in this story, which I loved seeing. So tell me a little bit about, you know, what it was like developing her character.
Alana, my baby, she is just contents under pressure at all times. And I usually, the kind of character I gravitate towards is a bit more of an underdog. So it was really fun to write Alana, who, as her mother derisively calls her, is the town's golden girl, the person who never messes up and in fact can never mess up, because if she does, it'll be catastrophic. So she's been walking this high wire her entire life, and she doesn't think anything of it. And of course, I knew that the best way to shake her up and put her on the path to sort of reevaluating all this pressure she's under is to have her make a mistake, which is, of course, part of the inciting incident. But I wanted to approach that mistake just with a lot of patience for her, a lot of empathy. Like, I didn't want, you know, certainly some of it is on Alana. She could have talked to the people around her, but of course, how would she have learned to do that? So I wanted to approach her taking accountability for this with sort of a mix of, okay, yes, this happened. Like, you can't change that, but also you were set up to fail from the very beginning. So for the most of the book, Alana is a bit of an unreliable narrator in a way I find really fun, both because some of her memories are missing, but also because she's sort of changing her entire conception of the way she was raised. I had a lot of fun unpacking that, both in terms of how Alana sees herself and how Alana sees her duty, and of course, how Alana sees her ex-girlfriend.
Yes, there's a lot of that with her ex-girlfriend. I really liked their relationship, because, you know, from the beginning, there were just these like small little quotes and things that happened, you know, like their exes But yet, you know, her ex-girlfriend, when they get together at one point towards the beginning of the book, calls her baby. And Alana's like thinking to herself, okay, well, I'm going to have to unpack that one later. Like, why is she still calling me baby? You know, like there's just all these kind of fun little things with her relationship. And I mean, any teenage girl in a relationship, like it's already, you know, just analyzing everything to the death, because that's what girls do. And yet, you know, and so, you know, they broke up, but they're still friends and they're still around each other. And now there's all this other stuff that's happening that's kind of encroaching on it. And they're being drawn closer and you're like, what's going to happen? And like, there's just so many, you know, aside from all the other things Alana is dealing with, now she's trying to unpack this relationship and what's happening there as well.
Right. So I loved writing them because like before the story started, they were just locked in the same fight for so long that when they broke up, spent some time apart, and like these terrible things happened to Alana, they now no longer know what kind of ground they're on, because mm-hmm. they have all this history and this concern for each other, but also they never actually resolved that fight to begin with.
Yeah, which definitely makes it tricky when you didn't really resolve anything. You know,
you can't exactly.
There's not like a wrapping on that. There's not a little bow all tied up. So
exactly.
It just brings another complication into this already complicated mess, but in a fun way.
I had a lot of fun with them. My debut, The Valley and the Flood, didn't have a romance in it. So I enjoyed diving back into the teen romance aspect a bit more.
Oh my gosh. Let me tell you, that is one thing I love about YA is like the teen romance and the drama that comes along with it. Partially because part of me is like, yeah, I remember that, you know, and thankfully I'll never have to go back to it. I'm past right. it. Right. But it's also just fun to read.
It is. I know. I feel like when I write like teen romance and like a lot of teenager point of view stuff, it's a lot of reverse engineering of my own feelings back then. And in the process, sort of figuring out what I was in fact feeling.
Yeah. You know, and there are so many feelings when you're a teenager. So
oh
many
yeah.
feelings.
And like Alana, I didn't always name them properly.
No, we never do when we're that age, you know, and even younger. Right. I teach middle school, and the feelings that these middle schoolers have and the things they tell me about their boyfriends and girlfriends, I'm like, oh my goodness. I'm like,
middle schoolers are braver than anybody else. Like that is just, that's a time to be in.
Oh yeah, it is. And it's great when you're out of it. So
oh, it's so great.
But yeah, one of the other things too that Alana deals with, and I was thinking about this as you were talking about, you know, the mistake that she makes and kind of what happens after that. You know, she's called the golden girl because she does, you know, all the things, and that's how, you know, what her mother said. And however, while we have the memory eater as kind of like our, you know, as our monster, right? We kind of have a monster in another form in this book too. And the woman on the council.
Lena,
thank you. Yes. She's like a whole other kind of monster in herself, you know?
She is the true monster of the book.
Yeah. And, it, you know, like poor Alana, you know, like how I keep thinking, like, as I was reading, you know, she makes this mistake. And so Lena is like breathing down her neck about it and literally right there with her, like every day to make sure this mistake doesn't happen again. And I was reading this and just kept thinking, oh my gosh, I would probably like go crazy if I had somebody like that monitoring me 24/7 every day because I made a mistake. You know what I mean? Like, it's crazy how Alana just has to deal with that too. Just one more thing she's got to deal with.
Exactly.
But
one piece of feedback I get fairly often is, I liked the book. I wish you were meaner to Lena at the end. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I should have been meaner.
I could totally see that. Because sometimes there's just, you know, she's like that character who you love to hate.
Well, it makes me happy that you hate her.
Awesome. Yes. See, because that means you did your job really well.
Exactly.
Alana, you know, like we've talked about, has so much going on. So she kind of has a lot of problem solving that she has to do. And, you know, she's put into a situation where she has to figure out how to get the memory eater back, because the memory eater escapes out of the cave. And so she has to figure out how to get the memory eater back before the memory eater does too much damage, you know, unwanted damage of eating these people's memories who don't want that to be done for all the people in Whistler Beach. And Alana is 17 years old, but she's having to think and act like a grown adult who's much older than that. And because all of these people too are like relying on her and looking to her, her best friend, her girlfriend, the, you know, her best friend's parents, like the council, Lena, and, you know, all these other people are like, you know, you need to do this or else we are all doomed.
Right.
So she's trying to, you know, she has to like grow up really fast, and she's got nobody. I mean, she has her best friend and her best friend's parents who she lives with to help her and support her, and her ex-girlfriend, but she doesn't have any like blood family. She doesn't have her grandmother anymore. Her mom is gone. And so even though, you know, the story that you've created is a fictional story, there are a lot of teenagers who kind of face, you know, similar situations where they're put in where they don't have their family members with them anymore. They're living with, like, you know, maybe like long distance relatives or in foster care or, you know, these types of things. And, you know, maybe they do get put in situations where they have to decide, you know, how to take care of a younger sibling or something else along those lines. And so what is something that you would want your teen readers who might be in a similar situation like this to take away from Alana's story?
This is a really good question. So one of the things I think I'm always unpacking in YA is that really complicated push and pull in teenagehood of the beginnings of your adulthood. Because on one hand, it's really exciting because you're getting to a part of your life where you're starting to figure yourself out a bit more. You get a bit more responsibility. Like maybe you encounter things that you're going to solve for yourself for the first time. And that's a really empowering feeling. But then it's also easy to take on a bit more responsibility than you should be carrying. And in fact, believe that you should be taking on more responsibility than you're carrying. And a lot of teens don't have a choice in doing so because, like Lena, who was sort of an amalgamation of many people I've met like this over the years, there are a lot of adults out there who will happily displace responsibility onto teenagers. And maybe they have no choice in doing so, but a lot of the time they just really didn't finish maturing themselves. And they see this person as practically an adult. So they're like, oh, here, you can carry this now. And I know, like, when I write YA, I know the message I'd give to myself as a teenager would be slow down, but a lot of my responsibility was self-inflicted. And so for the teens who like can't set that responsibility down just yet, I guess I would hope that they take away that accepting help or making mistakes is not failure. It's what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And most, like, not all problems, and in fact, many problems aren't yours to solve. Like, that is way above your pay grade. I know it doesn't feel like you can let it go, and sometimes you can't afford to fully let it go, but you deserve somewhere where you're supported and you can grow and you can make mistakes and be safe.
And that makes so much sense. And that's something that I actually tell my students a lot is, you know, like, we're all going to make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. I say something stupid or pull up a wrong slide or, you know, make a mistake while I'm teaching. Like,
right.
I mean, we all make mistakes, but we have to learn from them and, you know, and move on. And like you said too, there are situations that teenagers or young adults are put in that they feel like is their fault, even though it's not, you know? And so they just take exactly. that responsibility onto their shoulders. And it's really hard to tell somebody, you know, once they've like really kind of gotten in that mind frame to be able to say, no, this is not your fault. Let it go. You know, it's really hard.
Yeah.
It's hard for them to let it go also, you know?
So exactly.
Something so many young adults struggle with, whether they're in high school or middle school.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said you were talking about, you know, telling them like to slow down too. And I've had conversations with students where I had a girl who was in eighth grade and she was just like, telling me how, you know, she wants to get a job like right now and, you know, and start saving. And I'm like, baby, slow down. Cause once you start working, you're never going to stop. I said, I got a job when I was 16 and I've worked every year of my life since then. And so it's, you know, and then in middle school, like I said before, a lot of these sixth graders, seventh graders, eighth graders are all talking about boyfriends and girlfriends and, you know, getting their hearts broken. They're literally in relationships that last like 2 weeks at the most sometimes because they're so young. And I'm like, just, that's another thing I'm constantly telling my students, you know, just don't rush that. You don't need to.
It's just, exactly. Whatever time you can take to just exist, protect that time because you get fewer and fewer opportunities to just exist.
Yes. Very, very few. The older you get, the less time there is.
Oh God. Yeah.
I just, you know, and depending on whatever career you end up doing, well, that's a whole other thing as far as how much time you have. So
exactly.
Yeah. Great, valuable lessons. And I always love, you know, reading young adult books like this where readers can really take a look and say, oh man, you know, I can relate to that because this is kind of what I'm going through too. And if she can come out and go through all of this and come out okay in the end, then, you know, I can too. So I love those positive messages in these young adult books. It's great.
I'm glad to hear that.
All right. What do you feel like was the most difficult part of writing The Memory Eater?
Ooh, so The Memory Eater was the very first book that I wrote on deadline. So I sold it to Razorbill as a proposal, and the proposal was three chapters and a synopsis. So I had a decent idea of where the book was going. I always know where it begins and ends and sort of the points of catharsis that the protagonist is going to encounter along the way. But there's a certain amount of discovery that I only get when I start writing. Like I am mostly, you know, as you know, the dichotomy is like plotter versus pantser. Mm-hmm. I am mostly a plotter, but I am very open for things to change in my outline, and they often do. So there was so much I figured out about The Memory Eater as I was going. And I also could have stood to learn how to make mistakes more in my teenage years because I'm a bit of a perfectionist. So it was really hard not to go back and edit. And I really had to just buckle down and say, okay, editing comes later, you keep going. And it's really difficult for me because I'm like, oh, those pages I just left behind are messy and they're going to haunt me. So it was difficult to keep to it. But what I realized along the way was that there was a certain amount of reverse engineering that I was doing. Like there were certain things I only figured out once I had a sketch of what their endpoint was going to be. So even though it felt like just the most like unforgivably messy project, by the time I finished, I suddenly knew what I was doing and I could see the story for the first time. So it was a long road, but The Memory Eater and I finally came to an understanding.
Oh, I'm glad you did. It's a very good understanding, in my opinion. I've heard a lot of, you know, authors kind of say the same type of thing about their second book, you know, because the debut novel, most of the time it's like, it's something that you've worked on like for years and years, kind of at your leisure. And then, you know, you send it out and it gets accepted and it goes out into the world. But then all of a sudden your next book, you have a deadline for, and exactly. It's like, ah, I don't know how to do this, you know?
Book two was very much a 6 month panic attack. And I was lucky to have 6 months. I know writers with their second books who have much less than that.
Well, and I know that there are writers who are on like book, let's see, what's she on now? Like nine. Like there's one who she's still like, she was posting on Instagram the other day, realizing my final draft is due today and I'm totally not ready. You know, like, and she's written like six, I don't even know, a lot of books already. So, you know, I feel like for some people, it maybe still stays around for a little bit, maybe depending on the book too.
Those are the nightmares I have. Like, you know, how you used to have the stress dreams that you forgot you were enrolled in a class and it's the final exam. Yes. My stress dreams are now that, and I have a launch today and I completely forgot about it.
Oh gosh. I can picture that. And what is it about that stress dream? Like every year, every semester in college, I would have that dream, like that it was finals week and I would wake up late and then I wouldn't be able to take my exams. Total stress dream.
Always. Yeah.
Every time.
We all have permutations of it. Like people are the same everywhere and they are stressed.
Yeah. It's so true. I loved hearing about your writing process too, and how, you know, you said you're mostly a plotter, but you've got a little bit of pantser in you in the middle. I feel like, and you said, you know, you kind of like know where it's going to end and then work backwards. I've always felt like if I were, I'm not going to because it's not me, but like if I were with the way that my brain works, I feel like I can relate to that. And that's how I would be too. Like I would have to know where it was going to end and then like go backwards and work my way to that point, you know?
Exactly. And like figuring out the middle that way. And I sort of picked this up by working with my wonderful friends who have screenwriting backgrounds, because screenwriters know form like nobody else. Mm-hmm. So they were sort of the people who taught me how to nail down those middles and work with the changing and evolving stakes. So that's something I've gotten better at, but it's still something I tend to figure out last.
Yeah, which makes sense. I'm telling you, I also have a lot of respect for screenwriters because wow. Like, and I've read through some like screenplays and I am like, oh my gosh, how does your brain even function to do this? Because there's truly so many things you have to think about. You know, you have to think about like the mise en scène, the like, what does it look like? What is the picture going to look like? Not just what you're writing physically, but like all the things. It's so insane.
Exactly. Delightful Hannah Ferguson, who used to be my agent, has since left agenting, but has a fabulous book coming out next month, The Infinite Miles. Oh, nice. They have a screenwriting background.
Very cool. Yeah, it's a whole other thing in and of itself. So
it really is.
But well, what did you enjoy the most about writing The Memory Eater?
I probably enjoyed Alana's relationships with everybody the most, because it covered a lot of types of relationships I really like. Mm-hmm. Like certainly I enjoyed her relationship with Charlie because of that sort of friendly but fraught back and forth. I loved writing her and Rue and how mutually supportive they were of each other. I enjoyed sort of the loving tension between Alana and Rue's parents as they sort of try to get her to remember that she's a child and she sort of resists that. But most of all, I loved writing Alana and the Memory Eater herself. When I think about how earlier versions of this book didn't have the Memory Eater, there's a reason they didn't get written. It's because they didn't have the Memory Eater. She was just, I love writing a monster character to begin with, but she was just a delight. Like every line of dialogue I wrote from her just poured out. I would write her forever.
She really is fantastic. I loved The Memory Eater too. And she and Alana do just have a great relationship. And I love how it develops because it's completely in one spot at the beginning and then in a totally different place at the end. And it has to be with all that happens in the middle. But it's a great relationship. It's so unique. It's something that only a Harlow could have with the Memory Eater. Nobody else can have that relationship. And I do love a lot of the lines that the Memory Eater has and her nickname for Alana as well. And it's just a very fun relationship in so many ways. Complicated, but fun.
Very complicated. I had a lot of fun with that opening scene between them. Mm-hmm. And I thought, like, when I wrote this, I was like, okay, this is the establishing character moment for them. When the Memory Eater sort of moves on from sort of taunting her a bit and starts pestering her about enrolling in AP calculus. It's like,
yes.
Oh, this is the best thing she has in terms of a parental figure right now.
Which is scary because it's a monster.
Which is terrifying.
But it's true.
Exactly.
But yeah, there are so many great relationships and I do love all the different types. Cause even with the other council, and I'm sorry, I cannot remember her name either. The other councilwoman, the two women who were together.
Yes, May and Ayako.
Yes, thank you. She's even got like different relationships with them and with their sons. And so there's so many different relationship types that are explored in the book. And it's just really, which makes it all that more intriguing and fun to read too, because because she has such a different relationship with each person, you know, you get those different perspectives from all the different people. And Alana's getting those different perspectives and opinions and thoughts from people. And then, you know, she's still thinking about her grandmother and what would grandma have done. And so there's that influence that's there too. So there's a lot that's going on, but it all comes together like very beautifully.
Oh, thank you. And this is why I love writing a small town, because there's nothing weirder than a community.
So true. Okay. One more question about Grammar Eater before I like become nosy to find out if you're working on anything new. I'm curious. So a lot of authors, you know, will say like that maybe one of the characters or whether it's their main character or a different one, tend to have some of their personality qualities in them. Is Alana like you at all, or any of the other characters? Are you sprinkled in there at all?
Ooh, I tend to crop up in different places, I think. Like, I think characters sort of take certain traits of mine and either sort of take them to an extreme or take them in a different direction. And I think I'm a bit of Alana in that, like, this is what would happen if my, like, perfectionistic streak was raised in a completely different environment. I think I'm probably closest to Rue, who's very, like, she's very loyal. She's very justice-oriented. I am not a civil service nerd like she is, but again, if I was raised in that environment, I might be very interested in sort of the granular ways of how the town worked. And especially if my best friend was responsible, I would think like, okay, how can we make life easier for her? Like, what could be changed to support her? So yeah. I think there was a lot of me in her.
Very fun. It's just always a fun question to ask and to kind of hear what the responses are too. And some authors are like, I love that there's parts of me in here. And other authors are like, I don't like that. It's there, but I wish it wasn't. And I have most definitely read some YA books where I'm reading a character and I'm like, oh my God, that's me. This is not
me. Too. Like,
and so I'm like, what's it like to write me? Like, I don't want to write me. You know what I mean? I don't know.
So. Exactly. This is why with my first book, The Valley and the Flood, I was very careful to make my protagonist Rose not me, because it's such an emotional book. And I was like, if she was me, this would be too much.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just crazy how that connection works, but yeah, it's fun. Okay. So now I do have to ask, this is my obligatory question because I need to know. So is there anything new that you're working on? Anything you can share about, I guess I should say, just in case.
Yes. So I am at the point where I'm in my little cave and I'm working on several things that I can't talk too much about. But I can say that one is more classic horror than anything I've done so far. And in fact, is a reference to one of our most classic pieces of horror in the Western canon. And one is another weird small town story that goes in a bit of a different direction and a bit of a new season, since we have now covered summer.
Ah, all right. They both sound very intriguing to me. What I have, something I've discovered about myself as I have gotten older, is that I can no longer really watch horror movies. Like, I just can't do it anymore. But I really have enjoyed discovering and reading YA horror books. Like, I have read some like thrillers that were just, you know, and some horror that I was just like, whoa, this is fantastic. Like, I don't want to watch this in a movie, but I will read it in a book. It's fine. So, so I'm really excited to, that you get to hear about you writing another, like a true, more horror book, because I will most definitely read that when that comes out. That's exciting.
Ooh, that makes me very happy.
Okay, good. Well, I just want to say thank you so much for being here, Rebecca. It's been so much fun chatting with you about The Memory Eater and a little bit about your first book as well. It popped up in there a few times. So yeah, it's been great. Is there anything you want to wrap up with and leave everyone? Or do you want to tell everybody your website and where they can purchase the Memory Eater?
Sure. Well, you can purchase the Memory Eater just about anywhere books are sold. But if you would like a signed copy, my local independent bookstore is Porter Square Books, and you can always order signed copies through there. My website is RebeccaMahoneyBooks.com. If you are still on Twitter, and I don't blame you if you're not, my username is Cafe Cliche. I am Cafe Cliche on Instagram as well, if you would like a less Elon Musk territory. And it was a pleasure chatting with you all.
Thank you. And I'll be sure to put links to all of that in the show notes for today. And I'll link to Porter Square Books as well. So that's way anybody can hop on there if they want to get a signed copy of the book. So
thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thank you everybody for listening. And again, if you have not yet read The Memory Eater, you should go out and get this book because it is fantastic and I highly recommend it. So thank you everybody for listening and we will chat again soon. Today's episode featured the book, The Memory Eater by Rebecca Mahoney. A very special thank you to Rebecca for being my guest on the podcast today and for chatting with me. And a special thank you to Lane Mandros at Books Forward for setting up the interview. YA Book Chat was created, hosted, and edited by me, Leah Stuhler.